After 8 for WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 to 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with a very talented writer, a Guggenheim Fellowship recipient, as a matter of fact, by the name of Darren Strauss. I first saw the name Darren Strauss because of a really intriguing novel of his called Cheng and Eng, based, of course, on those two men who were world famous as the original Siamese twins. Other books by him include his memoir, Half a Life, and More Than It Hurts You. His most recent book is what we talk about today, a book called The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story. This is a book that is a novel, but that very much is full of fact alongside the fiction, a memoir and novel kind of wrapped up into one. It is based on the remarkable career of Lucille Ball, and in particular, a particular pivotal point in her life and career, and based on a very intriguing idea, that of the author's grandfather, one Isidore Strauss, having had an affair with Lucille Ball. One reads those words right on the page and one imagines, you know, what kind of a book would this be? Well, it's a great book. It's wonderfully written and so intriguing. And somehow along the way, even though it is a book, of course, that is to such a large measure fiction, there is a truth and authenticity to it that is most impressive. This book, again, is titled The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story, published by Random House. And Darren Strauss, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Greg, wow, that was an incredible introduction. Thank you so much.
I have enjoyed this book very much. And I want to say parenthetically, I didn't think I would. That is, when I read its description and kind of knew what it was, this is not the kind of book that I typically enjoy. I think I am a reader, and I'm also a viewer of film and television, in which I really am more comfortable when the genres are more kind of cleanly delineated. I mean, I didn't really like Forrest Gump, for instance, because, I mean, although most of the world adored that movie. But to me, I just find myself typically uneasy as a viewer or a reader when I feel like the lines between truth and fiction are blurred. This is one of the rare instances in which it didn't bother me a bit. It drew me in, and I really loved the book, and I mean that very sincerely. I wonder, let's just start there. When we are talking about a book that blends fact and fiction, and you've done this before, what kinds of things are you thinking about as the author? in terms of how to craft such a book and how to balance those elements?
Yeah, great question, and thanks. And you know, the funny thing is I didn't like Forrest Gump that much either. I actually have had to talk about this a lot. You know, I think people were sort of skeptical, or some people were skeptical about this. You know, there are times when I think that's really irresponsible to do that sort of thing. Like, for example, the movie JFK. I found that really irresponsible because that was purported to be fiction, rather that was fiction, but purported in a way to be nonfiction because the filmmaker Oliver Stone made it seem as if he had some new insights about a really important thing in American history. Right, he was talking about the murder of JFK, and so, you know, I think if you are clear up front that it's just fiction, you're not trying to push any new theories or spread what is now called fake news and just want to entertain, I think it's a different story. But I really did want to be respectful to Lucille Ball and to the truth. And the reason I told the book in this way, if you don't mind me going on this long,
not at
is,
all.
You know, I just wanted to find the most entertaining way to tell her story. And the most truthful, as you said, because I've read a bunch of biographies of Lucille Ball, and I really wanted to tell her story because I think she's an amazing woman, and we can get into why, I guess, after. But the biographies were quite dry. I mean, they could tell you certain facts. For example, her show was so successful that in most major cities, the water tables would drop whenever she cut to commercial because the entire city would go to the bathroom at the same time. So she had the whole country flushing toilets at the same time, which is sort of amazing. Her show had the equivalent of 90 million viewers a week, basically. So that it can tell you. But because she was a withholding person, it can't really tell you what it was like to be her. It can't give you the texture of her life. And so I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. And then the problem when you write fiction, because I've written a bunch of novels, is often when you write a novel, you ask yourself, does this make sense? Is this character compelling? Well, I figured if I wrote about Lucille Ball, I know it would make sense. I know it would be compelling because she's so compelling. So I thought, you know, if I mix the things that benefit writers in writing novels and the things that benefit writers in writing nonfiction, I could write, you know, a really fun, really engaging, and hopefully really informative book about Lucille Ball.
You did something similar with your previous book, Cheng and Eng. We're not here to talk about that book, but because that is the way I first became acquainted with your writing, I wonder if you could just say a word about the comparison between that experience, writing about them and their lives in that form of a novel rich in historical truth, versus this particular book, which is based largely on truth about Lucille Ball, but heavily balanced with fiction. Are the two books quite similar in terms of how they felt to you as you wrote them, and the kind of, let's call it, alchemy or chemistry of blending fact and fiction, or were they maybe different from each other for any number of reasons?
That's a great question. I feel like they are different. I mean, that was my first book, and I had just finished studying with E.L. Doctorow, who's a great writer of historical fiction. So he had written the book Ragtime, which did take true characters and mix them into history. So that was sort of my introduction to that practice. But as my first book, I think it was much simpler. I just sort of took this story that people didn't really know much about. I mean, people knew the names of Chang and Eng, these conjoined twins, and I just sort of told a novel about it. And then I went off and wrote five other books. So, you know, I wrote a contemporary novel, I wrote memoir, and then I wanted to write the story of Lucille Ball, but I wanted to do it in a more rich way, and I feel like I had more chops to do it this time. I mean, this book, as you mentioned, isn't just about Lucille Ball. It's about my family, so it's a family memoir. So it's a story of my grandfather and his story, and my grandmother and their story, and they're named, and it's basically 100% true. So it's a family memoir. Then it's a kind of a biography of Lucille's golden period, and you know she's so well known that I couldn't play loose with the truth. And then there's the fictional element, and then there's also running through the book a small contemporary story about me. So I feel like I didn't have the skills to write this book earlier because it really took a lot of juggling to get these stories right. In fact, the first draft of this book was 650 pages. Now it's 300 pages, but I had to cut out an entire storyline that I wrote with it that didn't work just to get everything lined up right. I mean, I think this is a much better and more complicated to tell story. I mean, I don't think it's a complicated story to read, but I think this was juggling a lot more balls, I think.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Darren Strauss, and we are talking about his most recent book called The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story. We're going to be exploring that in just a moment. Darren Strauss, I neglected to mention in my introduction that you are apparently a clinical professor of fiction in the graduate writing program at New York University. And I'm afraid if I don't ask you this now, we're going to run out of time and I will not have the opportunity. So this was supposed to be the first question. It's the fifth question or whatever. But I just smiled when I saw professor of fiction. I don't know that I've ever seen those words before. So explain what a clinical professor of fiction teaches. And how that folds into your life as also an active and best-selling author.
It's sort of an embarrassing title. I just think academia is kind of silly, and so that was the title that they had in order to get me a certain number of classes. I don't know what clinical means in this context. I just teach writing to students, undergrads and grads, and they hand in their work, and we, as a class, critique it, and I sort of try to teach them the tenets of fiction writing. I'm not one of those people who believes that writing can't be taught. I don't know where that comes from. I think it maybe comes from the fact that we don't leave a graduate writing program as Tolstoy automatically, right? But I don't know that invalidates the practice of teaching writing. I feel like not everyone who leaves law school is Clarence Darrow, but it certainly makes you a better lawyer. And I think people come in, learn how to write, and leave. And I've had a bunch of students publish and have successful careers. So, but the term clinical professor of fiction is something that's a little embarrassing.
A little highfalutin, and yet...
A little highfalutin.
Right, and yet what an exciting thing to do. And... just in a nutshell, when you are trying to help a young, aspiring writer to be more effective when it comes to fiction, what are kind of the bedrock basics that that you explore in the classroom, and that you are trying to help them in a sense improve upon?
Oh, wow, that's a good question too. I think what I do is we look at books. Not as they look at them in English classes to talk about theme or social impact or anything. We look at it and say, okay, how is this put together? What makes this boring or what makes this exciting? And how do you replicate that? Or what makes good dialogue? What's a good thing to think about when you begin a story? Yeah, you know, we just sort of take things apart. I think they're, you know, it's a craft like anything else. A painter can look at paintings and figure out how it's done. I know you teach music, right?
I do. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so you know, it's similar. You know, how do you as a singer learn how to breathe or you know what is music theory, all that stuff. So I think it's any art seems mysterious to people who don't practice it, but once you start doing it, you figure out, okay, yeah, there are tricks to this, and there are things to avoid and things to do.
Very good. Let's dig into some more specifics about this particular book, your newest book, again, called The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story. And again, we want to say that this is a book that mixes fact and fiction, memoir and novel, and is largely based on what we know about Lucille Ball, and woven into it is this intriguing possibility of Darren Strauss, the author of his grandfather, Isidore Strauss, having had actually an affair with Lucille Ball. Before we talk about your choice to create this possibility at the heart of this book, let's learn more about who your grandfather actually was, and for that matter, your grandmother, and what they were like, what they did, where they lived, whatever you think is important for us to know about them.
Yeah, so my great-grandfather, my grandfather's father, it's sort of a typical immigrant story. He came over here at the turn of the century with nothing. He was from Russia, and his older brother was here, and he was 13, and he was sent here because there was some hardship back home. So he came to America in 1900, and at 13 arrived at Ellis Island in New York, and his brother wasn't there. He didn't show up. So it was a 13-year-old kid with no money and no English, and he walked off into New York City, and somehow 20 years later, he walked out a millionaire. I mean, it was a real American story. He worked really hard. He somehow got into real estate and then ended up owning all these buildings in New York City. And I say that my grandfather then had the singular talent of somehow being able to inherit a number of high-rises in Manhattan and still end up flat broke. It's almost impossible to lose money at the rate my grandfather did. He was just a terrible businessman. So by the time I arrived, there was nothing left of this sort of family fortune that my great-grandfather had built up. And it was because my grandfather wanted to be a poet. And his father said, no, you have to take over the family business. And he did. You know, he was an old-fashioned guy, and he was told he had to respect his father. And so he did what his father said, and then drove the business into the dirt. So I, you know, was always sort of moved by that and became a writer maybe in response to that. And, you know, my grandfather did meet Lucille Ball at this party, and so I was always intrigued by that. And the party happened to have been thrown, and this is the beginning of the book, the party happened to have been thrown by Donald Trump's father. So Donald Trump's father bought a bunch of land in New York's Coney Island, and one of the things he owned was this really beautiful glass and steel landmark. And it was called the Palace of Fun, and it was a really important, beautiful building, so Trump's father wanted to tear it down and make crappy housing, as you know, developers did. So in order to avoid scandal, Trump Sr., invited a bunch of real estate people, like my grandfather, and a bunch of celebrities, like Lucille Ball, to this beach in Coney Island, and invited the press. And at the stroke of midnight, the celebrities threw bricks through this glass building and destroyed it. And the press took photos, and everyone thought, wow, that's a really glamorous thing, and sort of elided over the fact that an important part of America was destroyed. So I thought that was sort of a very novelistic and cool opening, and it was true. And the funny thing is, I started writing the book before, I mean, this book took me a long time to write, so I started writing this book before Trump had even declared for president. So it seemed just like a cinematic opening when I first started writing it, and now there's so many more political implications that it seems, I got lucky in that I guess it seems more resonant even than I had planned when I started writing it.
Hmm. So tell us how well you knew your grandfather. I mean, I guess I should start with, did you know your grandfather? Did he live long enough to be any kind of meaningful part of your life and for you to have actually personally known him?
He was, and I really loved him, and my whole family loved him, and that was one of the interesting things about him was that he did these things that you'd think would be hard to forgive, and somehow my family kept forgiving him, and I think it was sort of because of his charm. So he abandoned my grandmother, left her, and she spent the last 30 years of her life as a hermit and an alcoholic in the house that they shared. And the sad thing, and so he left her, actually, he left my grandmother for her best friend and lived with her best friend as a kind of common law marriage for 3 decades. And one of the saddest things I've ever witnessed was I was there in my grandmother's deathbed. She was in hospice, and she was talking to the nurse about her husband as if they were still married, and that's just the way she conducted her life for the last 30 years. She just pretended they were still married. I mean, she not only forgave him, she acted as if it never happened, and I found that fascinating. And as I said, my grandfather drove his once prosperous business into the ground, and my entire family, except for me, is in real estate. So my uncle, my cousin, my father, every man in the family, for some reason, the women didn't pursue it, but every man in the family is in real estate except for me. And my father and uncle were quite good at it. And when my grandfather was losing his business, everyone sort of assumed he would ask his sons to help him. And he never did, and that really hurt them. And then, you know, the family business was destroyed. And still my father and my uncle completely love my grandfather and have no ill will. And so I just think it's really interesting how charm and personality can sort of mask all these things that people might do. And so that was another thing I wanted to examine.
Hmm. So the question is, in terms of crafting this novel and putting at the heart of it the possibility of your grandfather, in fact, having had an affair with the one and only Lucille Ball. First of all, I assume that you talked with members of your family about this possibility. How was this idea received by others in your family who knew your grandfather and might understandably have had some concerns about what it would mean to create a story with your grandfather playing this kind of role?
There's a Yiddish saying, which is, a family is doomed when a writer is born into it. So I think that there's maybe some truth in that. You know, my family was fine with it for the most part because I'm pretty clear that it's a novel. And, you know, I think my grandfather did cheat on my grandmother and abandoned her. And so, you know, I think this was a way for the whole family to sort of work through that. But, yeah, there are some people who are not going to read it and are angry with it. I think, you know, you ruffle some feathers when you do stuff like this. But the interesting thing for me is I feel closer to both my grandparents now than I did when I started writing it. There's a saying from the writer Amy Hempel, a devil on the page, an angel to the reader. And I think that means if you write someone and show their flaws, the reader can appreciate that person and come to love them even more because no one is perfect. And so if you write a perfect character, the reader isn't going to sort of believe or fall in love in any way with that character. So I, you know, in dealing with my grandfather's flaws, I had to sort of give him due process and write about him and say, well, why was he like this? And so I think it's a really fair picture of him. And my grandmother was a very small part of the story when I first started writing it. But in writing the story, I realized I had a lot of unresolved feelings towards her, and she ended up becoming kind of the hero of the book in a way. I mean, when I grew up, she was, as I said, an alcoholic, and she was a very mean drunk. So I loved my grandfather, even though he had, you know, walked out on her and done all these things. And I didn't really feel that close to my grandmother. But, you know, in writing this, I realized, well, she grew up she was an adult in a very hard time for women and had to deal with ignorance about a lot of things. I mean, we didn't know that much about alcoholism in the 60s and 70s, or not as much about how to deal with it. So no one ever tried to get her help or anything. So I ended up really coming to feel closer to both of them. So I think people in my family have had concerns and then read the book and feel like, okay, well, this is a fair picture of everybody. Same thing with Lucille Ball fans. Actually, I heard from someone who was friends with Lucille Ball. This guy, what's his name? Jeffrey Tannen. who wrote a book about his friendship with her. And he said, you know, how dare you tell this story? And I said, well, maybe read the book before you condemn it. And he just wrote me and said, yeah, I think it's a beautiful sort of love letter to her. So, you know, as you said, I think I've won over a lot of skeptics.
Hmm. And I think one of the intriguing things about it, and by the way, my skepticism before I read the book had more to do with kind of this genre of fact and fiction blending versus this idea of creating this affair, a fictional account of an affair that may or may not have ever occurred. But I can see how someone else, loyal either to the memory of your grandfather or loyal to Lucille Ball, might resent that possibility. I think one of the things you do that I appreciate is that you create this in the most possible, most positive terms possible. That is, this is not something that happens out of recklessness or selfishness or anything like that. And not that you exactly paint it as a good thing that should have happened, but we understand, in a sense, why it happened, and from both directions. At one point in the book, I think you're quoting some great writer I think it's Proust, saying the prospect of infidelity is the key to marriage. I'd never read that before. I wonder if you could just say a word about how you think that tends to be true, and how it was perhaps true in this specific instance.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I came across that quote, and I thought it was really interesting. And I'm not, but I wasn't sure it was true. And I have my character question it too, because the idea, I guess, is that for a spouse to remain engaged, the spouse should think, well, this person's still appealing to other people, and so I have to keep my game going in order to make sure that they don't stray. And that seems maybe a very French way of looking at marriage. But I think, having been married now for quite some time, I've been married since 2004, I don't know if that's true. It's complicated. Maybe it's true for some people. I also think if you suspect your spouse of straying, you might be so angry you'd leave. But for my character, it was a way of sort of thinking about the morality of the situation. He was trying to convince himself that he wasn't a bad person. So what I found interesting about my grandfather in this story was he was very concerned with morality and wanted to be a good person, and yet was having this extramarital affair, and so did all this sort of mental gymnastics to convince himself he wasn't doing wrong. And it's funny, you very kindly mentioned that you thought the one thing that worked in the book was that I don't condemn anybody, that I give everyone a sort of fair shake, showing them doing things that might be morally dubious. And I think that's the job of literature. I mean, there's a great quote from Saul Bellow, the Nobel Prize-winning American writer. And he said, when you write, you become familiar with due process. You have to give all your characters due process. And I think that means, if you're a good writer, you want to be a defense attorney for your villains, and so that means say, yeah, he did bad things, but here's why. And maybe even be a prosecutor against your heroes. Because, again, you don't want to write a perfect person, so you want to say, yeah, she's a really good character, but here's maybe an area where she's not perfect. And so if you do that, you end up showing people in all their messiness, because I think we're all complex, and so there's no really a delineation between he's a great person and she's a terrible person, or vice versa. I mean, there are certainly terrible people, but for the most part, we're a mixture of good and bad, I think.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Darren Strauss, and we are talking about his newest book, which is called The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story. And it occurs to me that in all of this time, we have not yet really talked very much about Lucille Ball herself, and that's what we're going to do now for the next few minutes. First of all, Tell us about your own relationship with Lucille Ball. Not that you ever knew her. I assume you didn't. But what you have thought of her over the years, and if anything in particular drew you to her as a key figure in one of your books.
Yeah. I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about her, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I mean, I was a teenager when she died, so I didn't really, and, you know, her show, her great show, she had four TV shows, but her really great, famous show ended 10 years before I was born, so I only got to know her in reruns. But even then, I knew how famous she was. I mean, as I mentioned a little earlier in the show, her show was so popular, it's really hard to fathom now. The most popular television show now is NCIS, which I think gets about 9 million viewers a week. She had 10 times that, as I mentioned, so that's just an incredible amount of viewership. I mean, 75% of homes with TVs watched her. Not even 75% of viewers. 75% of homes with TVs, that counts people who are out to dinner. So, you know, something like 85% of people who are home watching TV watched her, which is just incredible. But that's only sort of the tip of the iceberg. Another really fascinating, cool thing she did is she forced CBS to air an interracial marriage. I mean, she was married to a Cuban guy, and it's funny the way definitions change, because actually today it might not be considered interracial because he was Cuban of Spanish heritage, and so is probably considered Caucasian, but back then it was considered an interracial marriage, and CBS said, absolutely not, we're not going to let you have a Cuban husband, we have a white, blonde man picked out for you, and she said, no, I really want to be with my husband. And so she forced them to do it, and then America really embraced this couple, and I think that probably helped racial attitudes progress a little bit in this country.
Hmm.
And the funny thing is she did it because, not for any grand social reason, but because she knew he would cheat on her if she wasn't with him all the time. So she said, I want Desi to be in the show because she figured if I'm off filming without him, he'll cheat. And the sad thing is he cheated anyway. So part of the reason I wrote the book, too, was to give her her measure of revenge. I mean, in the middle of her fame, he was caught with two prostitutes in Confidential magazine, you know, which is the basis of the movie L.A. Confidential, did this big expose about him and all his affairs. And so that was really publicly humiliating for her. But you know, she's a very powerful, cool figure. She also was an executive, the first female mogul in Hollywood. She owned more studio space at the end of her career than any studio, and was a really good executive. I mean, no one else in Hollywood wanted to take a chance on Star Trek, and she did. And so the reason we have Star Trek, which led to Star Wars, which led to basically modern blockbuster entertainment, is because she took a chance on this weird show that was pitched to her as the UN in space. And she said, that sounds good. You see, all the networks said, that sounds really weird. No, thank you. So I thought that, I just think she's just a fascinating figure in many ways and really wanted to get her story out there.
Explain to our listeners the title, The Queen of Tuesday.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it's fiction, and so I really wanted to make sure that people did not think this was a biography. And I wanted to make sure people knew this was fiction and not, you know, fake news, as they say. So her show was on Monday night. And I, in order to show the reader that this is a novel, I changed it to some facts and mentioned at the end that I did that. So I put her show on Tuesday night. And I thought it was just a cool title. I originally was going to have her on Monday night. And then I thought, The Queen of Monday is just a bad title. People hate Mondays, so no one wants to read a book called The Queen of Monday. So I changed it to The Queen of Tuesday and then changed the day of her show. And that was a sort of wink to her big fans to say, yes, I know this is fiction.
Hmm. I think one of the best choices that you make among many in this book is that where the story begins is at such a pivotal point in her life and career. a point when things are not going very well, and her extraordinary and groundbreaking success with I Love Lucy was still in the future and by no means assured. Explain to our listeners what was going on with Lucille Ball professionally at this point in time when your novel begins with that extraordinary party on the beach hosted by Fred Trump. What was going on with Lucille Ball professionally at that point in time, and for that matter, with her husband Desi Arnaz as well?
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, one of the things I admire most about her is her determination. I think that's what people respond to. I'll tell her history really quickly. She, at 16 years old, lived in a very small town in upstate New York and ran away and came to New York City to become famous and was sent home by a producer who said, "You don't have it. You're not pretty. You're not talented. You're never going to be famous. Go home." And she ran away 10 times from high school and kept trying, kept coming back, and never made it in New York City. And then she said, "Okay, I'm going to go to L.A. and try to make it in Hollywood." And then barely made it. I mean, she took many years to get into movies, and then she did get into movies, but never as a big star, and then started to fail there. She had been in a bunch of B-movies, and for a brief time was called the Queen of the Bees, which is a sort of derogatory term for success, meaning that she could be in bad movies, but never good ones. And even that she didn't succeed at for long, because she was fired from MGM and then went to RKO and was fired from RKO. And she had been on the radio then and then failed at the radio. The radio show wasn't going so well. So her last chance at fame was TV, which at this point was a pretty iffy proposition. No one knew if TV could really make it. So it's hard to imagine now, but from 16 to 40, she was a failure and just kept trying. And she said about herself, "You know, I don't know why I'm famous. I'm not the best actress. I can't write jokes. I'm not a great singer. I can't sing. I can't dance. I'm not the prettiest." And this is, remember, was the 50s when, you know, a female actress, when actresses' looks were very important. I mean, it's hard now for actresses to overcome that, but think about it in the 50s. So all these things were stacked against her, and she just kept trying. And I think she was a brilliant comic actress, but she needed all the right elements to be in place in order for that to work. And it was really just her determination that kept her going. And I think she realized that. And so if you think about the show is about a woman who's not that talented, always trying to become famous, always trying to get into Desi's show. And so I think it was playing out her life in some way.
Hmm. Interesting. I've actually never, ever stopped to think about that for the hundreds of times I've watched I Love Lucy over the years. I think you're absolutely right.
I never did either. It was only in writing it that I realized, oh, my God, this is her life.
Yeah, interesting. At one point, you have her thinking to herself, with MGM having terminated her contract, after 20 bit part years, although still kind of young, she's also probably washed up. And that has to be so painful and so scary for a performer at that point in their career, tasting some success but not as much success as they knew was possible, and fearing that that's all the success they're ever going to have, and that from here it is going to be a slow slide into obscurity. And this has to be, a really frightening prospect. The picture you paint of Desi Arnaz is also of one of frustration, that things have not panned out to the extent that he hoped. And at one point you have him, or someone thinking to himself, like everyone who has lost or nearly grabbed real success, Desi Arnaz considers himself wronged by the world. And of course, to whatever extent that's true, that might also help to some extent explain why he lived the life that he did, or lived life the way he did.
I think exactly right. Yeah, I mean, that's an easy thing for, I think, any creative person can easily feel that way, you know. I think as a writer, I've certainly had those fears all the time. I think it's just something everyone fears, even those who are successful. I mean, I remember, I can't remember who said this quote. It might have been Auden or someone, but I think the quote was, every successful career looks like a failure from the inside. Because you know all the times you got bad reviews or came close to getting something. And in her case, it was true. She really was close to failure at that point. And then, amazingly, a year later had success unprecedented in this country. I mean, she really was probably the most famous woman in the history of America at that point, by some measures. And right before that, she was a failure. And I feel like that's an uplifting kind of American story, too, that, you know, there is hope. So I really, really wanted to examine that, the feeling of failure right before success and insecurities and confidence and how those all play into each other.
Mm. And, of course, the plan that Lucy and Desi have at that point is to try to hatch this this new project that will be a creative partnership for them. And it's not just a matter of looking for success, but as you said earlier, it is also, as far as Lucille Ball is concerned, perhaps the only path to saving her marriage. She thinks at one point working with her husband was the only chance she'd have to dust off her marriage and get it back on her feet. Something else I want to ask you specifically about is something that is said at this memorable party on the beach hosted by Fred Trump, the father of our current president, and something that he says that speaks, I think, so powerfully to the place of women in the world of entertainment at this point in time. I'm just going to read this passage, if you don't mind. So Fred Trump has walked up to the microphone, and as you said earlier, at this memorable moment, everyone, all these party guests are going to be throwing bricks and, in a sense, destroying this building. But ahead of that happening, he's at the mic. "Gentlemen," he says, and the fat microphone crackles. He is ignoring the light rain. "Thank you for coming. And ladies, can't forget them. They're too expensive. General laughter, except for Lucille." No, that's what we are, she thinks, in this year of our grace, 1949. Expensive adornments, investments, showpieces, forming the thought even as she orders herself to smile. Because men are where you sink your youth and hopes, with all their sturdiness, caution, their slowness to engage. They're hard to motivate. Oxen. She'd like to broadcast something that gets this across, but also funny. How to make a man do what you want. And even when he sees your stratagem, and even if you give him the consolation prize of thinking you're a fool, you've still got what you want. So wrapped up in those words is the kernel of the idea for, of course, I Love Lucy. But ahead of that, I think you are speaking so perceptively, and it's not the only time in the book, that we are shown inside some of the frustration and hurt that Lucille Ball is feeling at this point in time as a woman of ambition and creativity in an entertainment world that is run almost entirely by men, and many of them with very outdated ideas about what women are capable of. Can you just speak to that important element in the story of Lucille Ball and this book?
Yeah, and first of all, your voice is so amazing that I'd love to hear you read more of it. You make the book sound better than it is, so thank you. I think if you write about people different from yourself as a novelist, you have to really jump into their heads and be respectful. You know, I think that, you know, if you're a man writing about a woman, or if you're writing about someone of a different ethnicity, you have to be really respectful, especially in this moment when we're sort of examining all that stuff. And so the way to justify telling stories about people different from yourself is to really try to think about their position. And so I wanted to sort of write, to justify writing about a woman, I felt like I had to almost write a feminist novel in a way. And so I had to really think about, okay, what is it like being a woman? And so the reason I think fiction is important and literature is important is because it can teach you empathy. And as a writer, I learned to be, I think, more empathetic toward starlets and certainly and probably women in general by having written this book. I mean, I think, you know, it was very hard. It's always hard, I think, to be a woman, but it was harder then in 1949. So I really had to try to put myself in those high heels and try to think, okay, what is it like?
Mm. A last question, and I wish we had more time to give you to talk about this. At one point, we read these words: "If you want to know a person, learn what she keeps herself from remembering." So when we want to really know Lucille Ball, what are the things that she kept herself from remembering?
Oh, good question. She had a very difficult childhood. Her father died when she was very young. And right as she heard he died, the window was open and a bird flew in the house. And so she hated birds for the rest of her life. And that seemed very cinematic to me, that image of the bird flying through her window. But it wasn't just that her father died. It was that her mom then immediately remarried and left her, went off to the Midwest to try to find a job. So she was in upstate New York, and her mom went to Detroit to try to find work with her new husband. And so she left Lucille with her step-grandparents. And so here's this girl who just lost her father, and then her mom leaves her, not even with her grandparents, but her step-grandparents and new step-grandparents. And so that's really hard for a kid, and I think that's probably why she tried so hard to become famous. I think she needed that love because she didn't have it growing up, and to such a great degree had known loss and loneliness. And she did not like to talk about that or think about it. And so that, I think, was the key to her.
Hmm. And a key to this story of supposed infidelity between Lucille Ball and your grandfather in that fictional kernel of the book, you write, in one of the moments when they are first meeting and Lucille Ball is thinking of this excitement, "It was lovely to remind yourself that life can still surprise you." One of my favorite lines from this book that I really loved start to finish, again called The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story published by Random House and the author Darren Strauss. Darren Strauss, congratulations on creating an absolutely terrific book. I am so glad that I got to read it, and I'm so glad that we got to talk about it. Very best wishes to you.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really lovely, and I'm glad you liked the book. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be spending most of our time with Holly Stanfield, who is with the Kenosha Unified School District. She directs most of the school district's musical theater presentations. And we're going to be finding out from her about how the show is going on, how the productions are going to be going ahead this school year, and the kind of precautions that they are taking to keep the students safe. On Wednesday's morning show, we will be previewing for you a concert that the Kenosha Symphony is going to be playing this coming weekend at Kemper Center, with a similar sort of story of how precautions will be taken to keep the musicians safe. Also on Wednesday, Jack Rose from the local chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 to 5, and Saturdays from 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And remember that you can still shop online at jackandrea.com.